Yet somewhere in the mysterious middle distance between true sleep and waking, there is a period in which the two zones of consciousness seem very close together. The Egyptians were aware of this. Most ancient people have noted this phenomenon. And they have declared that it was in these small hours of the morning that the two worlds, the visible and the invisible, were the closest together. And that, for that reason, births are most numerous at this time, and so are deaths. For in these hours, situations come to such a fine edge that the two states of existence seem to mingle and move together and flow into one, and then gradually, as the hours proceed, separate again, with man returning to an objective or exterior consciousness. Visions of importance presented to us by the psychic nature are very little value unless we are able to record them. Therefore, what we actually need is a kind of sleeping in which memory and certain other faculties are still somewhat alert. If we have a total obliteration of faculties, we will have no adequate recollection of the dream. Other conditions, of course, other than the hour itself, may influence this. The individual may find that at a certain time, under pressure, worry, fear, or other burdens, that he does not sleep well. And this suspension, this condition of half sleep and half waking, may occur at other hours due to the disturbances of his life. But one apparent fact remains, namely that the valid vision demands a certain degree of both subjective and objective awareness. It demands that the subjective be active and positive, and that the objective be partly active but receptive. Thus we may have the psychic experience flow from the invisible roots of the mind to be finally recorded in the subtle substances of the brain itself. Unless this record is made, the project is imperfect. The record itself can have a number of meanings and will very often be presented as most dream phenomena in a series of symbols. Some of the masters of psychology today like to think of certain dreams as archetypal, that they are accompanied by a different state of the consciousness from ordinary dreaming, which may originate from any form of one form or another of the psychic pressure of the lower mind itself. Dreams can arise, therefore, from the pressure of the lower psyche, which because of its various afflictions or distortions or disfigurements through tension, stress, and neurotic situations, becomes the source of symbolic dream by which its abnormalcy is revealed. Thus, by means of a certain kind of dream, the lower psyche tells us that it is sick. These dreams are of a diagnostic nature. They can be analyzed and studied, and from them, the condition of the mental-emotional complex can be determined with some accuracy. The type of dream to which we are referring, however, primarily, the archetypal dream, is of a different kind. It is a directive dream. It is the kind of a vision or experience that is not to be regarded as an hallucination or merely a fantasy of sleep. It is meaningful and purposed. It is not completely diagnostic. It does not necessarily tell us what is the matter with us, although it may reveal in its own message certain things that are wrong and try to help us to correct them. The main purpose of the dream of this nature is directive. The vision is a directive, purposeful appearance which comes to us out of the directive and purposeful parts of our own subjective. It is therefore a dream of authority. It is a dream which expresses the will of the superior nature of ourselves. And as this superior nature is more aware of truth or more aware of reality than we are, it is customary to consider that such dreams as this are also indicative of the will of God, or the will of truth, or the manifestation of those laws which must be kept, those principles which cannot be violated. The archetypal dream, then, is a dream of realities, and it is usually accompanied by certain symptoms or certain conditions by which we are able to differentiate it from other dreams. Archetypal dreams are often described by the person who has them as waking experiences. The person is loath to believe that he is asleep. He is inclined to feel that he awakened before this vision appeared. And I have talked to a great many persons who have had this type of experience during sleeping hours, or when, normally speaking, it would be assumed that they were asleep, and yet they insist that they were awake when the experience happened. You may go a little further with them in this questioning, however. You may ask them, well, if you were awake, what did you do? Being awake, what would you do? Did you jump out of bed? Did you sit up? Did you reach for a pencil and paper to record this experience? What did you say yourself? How did you think? What did you feel? Answers to these questions are always dim and evasive. One individual will say, well, I didn't move, I couldn't move, because the experience itself seemed to paralyze me. I was conscious, but I could not move. Another one will say, well, my eyes were open, I could see, I know I could see, because I closed my eyes, and when I closed my eyes, the vision wasn't there. Therefore, it had to have been something that had a solidity outside of myself. But at the moment of the experience, I did not feel like doing anything. I fell in a strange state of suspension. I knew I was awake, but I did not move, I did not want to move, I could not speak. All of the normal functions were suspended. An occasion, of course, once in a great while, you will have a dream of this kind, or a vision, in which some other person is in the room at the time. This is not so common, but it does happen. And I know in one case that a person who explained the vision and told of having apparently reacted quite physically and to have been wide awake, and the other person testified definitely that the person was completely asleep through the entire process. Yet the person having the vision could not believe that he was asleep. Thus the vision differs from the dream in this peculiar validity of the sense of waking, or the sense of conscious awareness. It does not have the same mysterious sense of merely being part of a shadow. It is not something through which you pass as a distinct experience, as merely a being moving through some strange region like the mysterious realms of Dante and Milton. And the vision experience is one in which something happens to you. You know about it. You sense it. It is meaningful. Often also the vision or circumstance of this nature is preceded by some rather mysterious situation. It is frequently preceded by a sense of extreme coldness or chill. And those who have recorded visions other than at night, who apparently have been picked up into a vision state while sitting at a table or while reading a book or something of this nature, nearly always report the sense of chill. They report a change in the atmosphere around them. What they are really telling us, of course, is a change in the circulation of their own bodies. The circulation seems to retire from the periphery and to center around certain vital areas of consciousness. This is something that is common to man in danger of shock. And very often a person subjected to a sudden danger has the sense of chill. Also, certain types of illness produce this feeling, which is generally regarded as a poor symptom. Actually, however, this sense of chill seems to be one way in which the individual tries to express or explain something which happens in sleep, but of which he is not aware when in the normal sleeping state, namely the tendency of the temperature of the body to lower. Most of those who have had visions, for instance, as we said, at tables or sitting outdoors under a tree watching the scenery or something of that nature, most persons reporting such visions also describe a certain sense of haziness, the approach of something resembling sleep. They are nodding, they are not fully objectively aware, they are not usually engaged in any active enterprise at that moment. They are resting, taking it easy, contemplating, or absorbed in some thought or study. In these moments, this mysterious pattern takes hold, and we find the individual suddenly receiving a tremendous impulse from within his own consciousness. Now, we all know, of course, the things seen around us in the physical world do not enter the brain and are not recorded as things seen. The material objective environment in which we live is carried into the brain in the form of impulses. We do not carry a picture of the chair, of this microphone, into the brain, although we appear to see it there. The eye picks up a certain image, transforms it into vibratory waves, and transfers these waves to the brain where they reassemble in the form of the object. This means that the form-creating process is also in the brain, and that vibrations striking the brain can be transformed into images by the processes of the brain itself. This means that an image projected from the interior part of man's psychic life and impressed upon the brain can take form there, can take image and likeness there, and can appear to be just as real and certain as any physical thing which the individual can see. A proof of this process is, of course, hypnosis. For in hypnosis, an imaginary person, or a person suggested into existence by the hypnotist, may be placed among a group of real persons. And the individual seeing the real persons will at the same time see a person existing only in his own mind. That person will fit completely into the scenery and landscape, will be just as natural in appearance as the others. There will be no way in which the person under hypnotic pressure can determine the difference between a real person and this other person. And if this other person is mingled with a dozen real persons, this person can walk among them, or appear to pass behind one or in front of another, and the human mental equipment will rationalize the entire situation so completely that the hypnotized person will be unable to determine which of those people in front of him is a physical reality and which one is an imagined being. In the same way, the hypnotist can block out one person from a group, so that of 12 persons, 11 will be visible and the 12th invisible. And this invisible person will be in the room with all the others, talking with them, conversing with them, walking among them, and be totally invisible, because the entire situation is controlled from the brain itself and not by the sensory perceptions as we know them. Thus, in a dream or in a vision, forms are engendered in the brain as the result of vibratory mental image patterns. Now we may ask what these image patterns might be that would cause this kind of a formation within the consciousness of the person. There are as yet no absolutely conclusive processes formularized. But the process seems to be this. All thought, whether it arises from observation or whether it arises from internal processes, all thought is vibration. Thoughts have within themselves their own vibratory patterns and images. A thought or an impression pressed upon the mind and transferred from the mind to the brain must there clothe itself in the available materials from which the brain can derive its images. The brain cannot derive its images from any material which is not within its range of perception and reflection. In other words, if the brain of man is going to interpret any symbol or energy, or to give form to any abstract idea, it must clothe that abstraction in something which the brain itself has objectively experienced. It is perfectly possible, therefore, for the brain to bestow any form with which it is familiar, but no form with which it is not familiar. The most abstract form that the brain apparently is capable of bestowing is simply light. The most abstract negation is darkness. Therefore, things otherwise beyond formation, beyond any experience by which form can be implied, have the tendency to appear as light, have the tendency to appear also as simple geometrical patterns arising in light or composed of light. These geometrical patterns are derived from basic psychic archetypes, but they must also exist in this world in order for the brain to be able to register them. At a very primitive time in man's experience, his own mental processes, apparently, attempted to create a differentiating procedure by means of which things natural could in some way be mentally separated from things supernatural. The brain, unable to experience a supernatural thing or to give form to a thing formless as far as faculties and perceptions are concerned, hit upon a strategy which has since been distributed throughout society. And that was the strategy of creating extraordinary forms out of compounds of ordinary ones. A man walking along the street is a natural form. A horse galloping down the road is a natural form. Yet how shall we suddenly create out of this situation the instrument of an unnatural form, a form by which we could appear to convey something that is not of this world? Well, if we take the upper part of the man and put it onto the lower part of the horse, we have a centaur. A centaur does not exist to our experience, yet it is composed of two creatures that do exist. Thus we have the symbol of something unworldly, something metaphysical, something transcendental, something out of this world, by the simple contrivance of combining two natural forms into what the mind recognizes as an impossible combination. This is a very common symbolic process and may have resulted in many of the ancient symbols which have descended to us from antiquity. Among the Chinese, the dragon was such a form. Among various peoples, satyrs and various nymphs and mermaids and other such creatures were these unnatural forms. They were forms by means of which the consciousness could convey the sense of unworldliness. This is still used in the medicine rituals of primitive peoples, in the mask cult, where the individual becomes superhuman by wearing a mask which completely conceals his natural features and conveys the impression of a monstrous or unnatural being. The brain, therefore, seems to hit upon this contrivance. Perhaps if it could not or did not, we would never have developed these cults among men. But they do exist and are in very common knowledge throughout the world. They represent unworldliness produced by distortion. Michelangelo recognized this in art, and we know that his great figure of Moses gains its tremendous authority by its deformity. For if this figure stood up, it would be in completely disproportion. But this we do not recognize, rather receiving a certain impact of unworldliness. The distortion has not been carried to the degree of the grotesque. It has simply broken our common acceptances of what constituted humanity, what constituted ordinary things. Oriental artists achieve the same effect when representing deities as of great size and human beings associated with them as small figures beside them. Here, the giganticness creates the unworldliness. So in the subconscious vision dream sequences, as for instance in the Apocalypse, we have the introduction of a number of mysterious composite creatures becoming symbols of ideas, means by which the brain, in receiving impulses, is able to combine abstractions and make them available to us through symbolic forms. The interpretation of these symbols and the mysterious meanings which they have remind us, of course, of the mysterious interpretation of the great figure in Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Here the king dreamt of this extraordinary figure with head of gold and feet of clay, and of the stone which was cast against its feet, and the image collapsed. And all of the soothsayers and interpreters of dreams and visions were invited to come and explain this strange dream. And finally the prophet did so and gained great distinction in the land. But these kinds of dreams, these kinds of experiences, appear to be archetypal inasmuch as they represent a meaning pressing from within, clothing itself in forms different from those of nature, yet near enough to nature for man to grasp their significance. Now, it is another peculiarity of this type of vision that the meaning or the explanation is frequently communicated with the form. Part of the processes of interpretation are carried on subconsciously even before the person having the vision is aware of the process. Others become apparent to us from objective contemplation, the process of applying the symbolism to known incidents in our own living gradually reveals the meaning. In any event, your archetypal dream, making use of innumerable subconscious contrivance, it takes form in the brain, takes form within the consciousness of the individual, and is projected from there in one way or another. Sometimes the projection is rather abstract and in itself mysterious. Many visions, the individual rather feels himself projected into the vision. He feels as Ezekiel did, that he suddenly is in the midst of the world of his own dream. Yet this is no common dream. This is no dream involving just ordinary personal problems. It is a cosmic dream. A dream of a universe made up of wheels within wheels. A dream of the Merkava or the chariot of righteousness, borne upon the powers and wings of the cherubim, in which sits the master of the mysteries. All these visions indicate archetypal insight. They represent some psychic truth, some message trying to break through into objectivity, some manner of communicating the abstract to faculties which are unable to receive the pressure of the direct abstract. The brain taking hold, for instance, of a form must be able to associate this form with a pattern or symbol. This was one of the great difficulties recorded in the development of primitive writing. Ancient peoples were able very early to develop symbols representing objects. They were able, for example, to tie symbols to certain gentle processes of man. The Egyptians, for example, when they wished to indicate walking, made pictures of feet. This seemed to be quite consistent. And, of course, in the early days, they made it even simpler by indicating the direction of the journey by the direction of the feet. It seemed to be very, very necessary. Our friends down in Central America, during their ancient period of developing written language, went further than feet. They made little footsteps, as though in sand, drawn upon their manuscripts. And these footsteps led from the symbol of one town to the symbol of another town, and indicated that a journey had been made from one place to another. This was not impossible. They also had excellent manners of incorporating known forms in symbolism. The Chinese had the same method. The Egyptians, when they wished to describe a cat, drew a picture of it. When they wanted to discuss a vulture, they drew a picture of it. The ancient peoples of other lands did the same thing. The Chinese ideoglyph for a horse has four long strokes at the bottom indicating legs and was originally a picture of the horse. In the course of time, and perhaps with the decay of artistry, it was no longer entirely convenient to draw a full horse every time you wanted to write about one. So gradually the glyph was simplified. But in the beginning, all of these forms were derived from nature. Then your ancient writer ran against his big problem. How was he to make pictures of things that were not visible? How could he make pictures of ideas? How could he draw a picture of virtue? Virtue didn't look like a cat or a dog. Virtue didn't have a nice, neat shape like a building or a house, nor did it shine like a star which could be represented by rays. Virtue was a quality. Honesty was a quality. Death was more than a quality, because you could indicate death by having a living thing lying down, indicating that it had ceased to live. But you couldn't just do that with virtue. Also, you had very grave trouble with verb forms, action of various kinds. Ordinary action you could understand. But if this action involved a very complicated procedure of some kind, the ingenuity of the artist and the ability of the beholder to correctly translate the art, both were stretched beyond a reasonable degree. There was very little way in which these abstractions could be represented. Therefore, gradually, man had to develop abstract forms to represent abstract powers. These forms could not simply be shown to someone. He had to receive the key to their meaning. Thus, gradually, a whole group of symbols appeared which had to be learned or remembered. And with that, the public school system came into its primordial existence, probably in the form of the old man of the tribe, instructing the young ones in the meaning of these forms that were not obvious. So all invisible beings, creatures, principles, energies, and powers came to be included among the unobvious forms. And the greatest surviving unobvious form of all in nature is the form of God. And among most primitive peoples, there was no symbol for the supreme deity, because man could not even conceive an appropriate symbol. Finally, the idea of no symbol suggested a crystallization or concretion of no symbol by simply taking an area and inscribing it or circumscribing it with a circle. The circle, therefore, became the symbol of infinity because it was an area in which there was nothing. The same thing was the principle behind the use of certain jade implements in China, where the flat disc with the opening in the center became the symbol of deity. The opening or hollow or empty place being the only possible symbol of God. So in this process of primitive man learning how to transmit ideas, we have perhaps the same mystery of vocabulary that we have in the human being's inner consciousness, trying to press moral abstractions upon the objective mind. One way, of course, is feeling. But here again, although feeling is an older sensory perception than sight, it is less specific. And in the effort to impress by feeling, it was necessary to in some way excite emotion. And this exciting of emotion again required some form of emotional symbolism. We find this in a good deal of mysticism, but it has never proven universally satisfactory. The individual feels certain compulsions and may follow them. But again, the vibration has been transformed from impulse to a specialized area of activities where this impulse is interpreted in terms of personal emotions. The point that I want to make primarily is that just as surely as outside symbols and thoughts enter into the brain through the perception, they are reintegrated into patterns. These patterns, in turn, subjected to further rationalization, leading to comprehension. So that comprehension and recognition and acceptance is due largely to a series of related impulses combining to form one basic concept. And it's just the same type of thing as Immanuel Kant gives us in his example of how we know that an apple is an apple. We certainly must know this by the use of many faculties and powers carrying their common report to a center in the brain where the puzzle is solved instantly and all the parts are fitted together. And if a major part is not present, then we are not certain that it is an apple. If some major necessary element does not contribute to the final project, our certainty is not adequate or not true. We must then go back, look again, touch again, smell again, taste again, to make sure that it is an apple. All of this process is in one direction, from the outer world into the core of man. The opposite motion is from a superior state above and beyond man, downward into the core of man. It is as though man's psychic nature was like the middle place in an hourglass. Energies moving from above enter the brain and have their impressions. Images moving from below enter the brain and have their impressions. And in the so-called vision situation, the energy from the superior part of consciousness moves in and imposes itself upon the brain processes, resulting in a number of possible explanations or manifestations. We may have what might be termed the auditory experience, in which we see nothing but hear something. This simply means that the brain itself has integrated vibration into sound. And we are hearing something inside of ourselves, although it may appear to be coming to us from the outside. In this matter, of course, our common attitudes play a part. To our general thinking, sound must come from the outside, for noise is of the outside. It therefore is inconsistent with our common experience to assume that sound would come from an invisible silence within us. It must rather come from the world of sound around us. And the inner sounds mingling with the outer sounds, we are unable to distinguish the source of one from the source of the other. Thus we frequently assume that we hear things said around us that are really from within us. The projection of images may also be attributed to the same process. An individual looking at a wall under certain conditions may see an image appear upon that wall, very much as in the old days of a stereopticon slide. This image upon the wall may be animate, move, and perform various actions, and even speak. But it is a projection within ourselves. The image seen on the wall is inside of us. The wall, however, is on the outside. And the combining of the wall and the interior image is like uniting two negatives in the production of a photograph in which two pictures are blended to form one picture. This double process of the picture, in this case, however, means that the picture arises in two different parts of consciousness, and the union takes place within the ordering faculties of the brain. Naturally, the brain itself, which is probably ordering this procedure without self-knowledge of its own ordering, being an instrument rather than a being, the brain is not aware of its own inability to discriminate between the interior and the exterior picture. So the whole consciousness of man is inclined to project the situation onto the outside, where it is familiar, where there is the least resistance, and where the greatest expectancies are likely to lurk. That brings us this other question that we find occasionally in cases of vision, in which the vision apparently must be on the outside because we can open and close our eyes. If we open our eyes and the vision is there, we close our eyes and the vision is not there, then the vision must be on the outside. This again is not true, as mental experimentation has shown. Remember that the moment we test an inner experience by means of some function of our own, we are undoubtedly and inevitably determined to achieve certain results. We have certain expectancies, and these expectancies are autonomic within ourselves. The average person expects something seen to disappear when he closes his eyes. And because this expectancy exists in the subtle substance of mental material, the expectancy is immediately fulfilled. Also, the voluntary action of opening and closing the eye may be enough in itself to temporarily disturb the image. But the real and common answer to this is that the individual, being the internal controller of the whole process, is able to create any verisimilitude which he wishes. If he insists that the image shall remain when his eyes are closed, it will remain. If he knows that it cannot remain, it will not remain. The mind is a magician in these things and will accomplish whatever we demand of it. And we know under hypnosis that this accomplishment or this acceptance of determination is instantaneous. Therefore, that it is useless to assume that we would have to argue ourselves into one concept or the other. That which we naturally accept immediately and inevitably occurs. Actually, we have almost complete evidence, not that a vision is false, but that a vision is communicated to man only because man is man, and in a way possible to man. We have never yet had true historical evidence of the intercession of deity in the affairs of men, except through men. We do not find someone meeting God on the street and asking him for something. We do not have the experience of the man who prays for financial help, having a hand reached down from heaven with a pocketbook in it. Man himself expects this help to occur or arise mysteriously, but he knows that this mystery will be associated with beings of his own kind. That where he needs help, help will come to him in a natural way. It is only the faith that it will occur and the conviction that the means will be provided in some supernatural way that adds mystery to the simple circumstance. Man is convinced, therefore, in all of his works and ways, that the God he seeks help from will give this help through its creatures and not in proper persons. That if the farmer prays for rain, it may rain. but the rain will be coming from clouds, not from a blue sky. That these clouds will gather in some way and according to their own laws and then precipitate. It may be that man is able to create artificial rain in some cases, but then he must reproduce natural processes in order to attain this end. So man has long learned that the great visions, the great mysteries, the great revelations that come to humanity come through highly sensitive persons who are regarded as prophets, messiahs, avatars, world teachers, seers, sages, and mystics. The vision comes to the sensitive person and is from him communicated to others who lack the sensitivity to have the experience themselves. Also, in some instances, experiences appear to occur to more than one person. This has long been a very difficult situation, but psychology is beginning to pick up the threads of it. It now realizes that what is termed the archetypal form, or the archetypal dream, arises as Plato's archetypes are known to have arisen from a pattern that exists in space. Under certain common problem or common stress or tension, this pattern may impinge itself upon more than one person at a time. There are instances, apparently, in which it has impinged itself upon a multitude of persons at one time, each one seeing the same thing, but each one of them seeing from within himself the agreement within the archetype. And the archetype imperiled upon the consciousness of the individual was sufficiently firm to produce a generally common experience. But each person saw within himself that which others saw likewise. But as each also beheld the occurrence as though outside of himself, we have the phenomenon of the multitude seeing at once. I know one case in which there was a very good report of this, in which several hundred persons saw the same thing at the same time. But these several hundred persons were among probably 100,000 persons, the rest not seeing it at all. Now, had the event been completely a physical, optical experience, all persons, except perhaps a very small group, highly defective in their optical equipment, would have seen it. But where seven men standing along the side of a ship all see a phantom ship, but seven more men standing alongside of them see nothing. If we must assume, rather, that an archetype of some kind has impressed those seven men, it is the only way in which we can seriously seek to solve the problem. For if the ship had actually been there and had been equally visible to all persons with equal optical equipment, they would all have seen it. Thus the vision as archetype may impinge itself upon more than one person. And there is indication, as in what are called the apocalyptical visions, that an archetype in nature gradually develops or unfolds to a degree of almost completeness, so that this archetype has a highly involved symbolism of its own. But the archetypal symbols are set within the function of a universal mind, operating similar to man's mind, but also in the process of transforming abstractions into orderly symbolic patterns. Under certain problems or processes, these collective archetypes can be impressed upon a number of minds simultaneously, and minds of a certain degree of sensitivity or receptivity will receive them, whereas other minds will not. We know this is true in practically every field of human activity, that what we term the law of exception depends upon the fact that even the most common circumstance cannot always be depended upon to occur to all persons. A certain remedy against an ailment may cure 90 cases and leave 10 untouched. Or a new drug may help 50 people, injure 20, and have no effect upon 30. The reasons for these differences lie within the person and not within the drug. The drug is an inanimate, impersonal thing, but it has to operate upon animate, personalized creatures, and their reactions depend upon themselves. A powerful impulse arising in the universal mind, an archetype or folk image, is itself impressed upon various persons. Some record it, some do not, some distort it. To some it is a great and wonderful experience, to others a terrible and dangerous experience, all depending upon the integration of the being upon whose abstract mental structure the impression is made. Generally speaking, then, I think we can say that the vision, generally and universally, is nature's method of conveying some form of knowledge, some form of knowing, beyond the normal capacity of the individual to comprehend. To do this, several factors are introduced. One is shock or stress, by which the entire experience is made important as being unusual, unique, or totally different. The second important factor is that it occurs and appears to occur to this person himself. It is not reported, it is not communicated, it is not conveyed. It is something which the person can afterward feel that he has known because it has happened to him. The next situation is that it must interpret itself in some material available for such interpretation. Where the materials are available, they will be used. Where they are not available, of materials relatively available will be grouped together in a new pattern or design in order that they may be the vehicle for an extraordinary idea. This very grouping, visualized by the individual within himself, becomes extremely important because it is strange or different, challenges his imagination and his thought, and invites him to the definite consideration of the experience as being valid or different, or important in itself. We know, for example, that in many parts of the world where Christianity has sent its missionaries, peoples coming under the influence of the Christian faith have mystical experiences. They have them in other religions also. But the point of interest is that nearly always where a person of one of these other groups has a vision relating to Christianity, this vision is always invested in the forms natural to that person. Mystics of China, for instance, who have had visions of Jesus, have drawn pictures of their visions, and in their visions, Jesus was always Chinese. He had to be, because he was drawn out of the subconscious repository of their own instinctive. They had to clothe him in the forms that they knew and understood. They could not hope to understand or comprehend him as a blonde Anglo-Saxon. They had no knowledge or acquaintance with such people. If, however, these Chinese later became acquainted with a number of Anglo-Saxons and saw numerous pictures of Jesus, until the subconscious was sufficiently impressed with this symbolism, then the mystical experience might well prevent him in his basically Anglo-Saxon or Teuton appearance, which probably also is entirely remote from his actual appearance. Because again, it is our archetype, our own racial and national concept, which has become the basis of most of our religious art. So in thinking through from sacred things outward, we always clothe them in the familiar. The vision, therefore, does create these forms in order to communicate. in order to impress itself upon us. Now, visions, of course, are not all valid. I am referring to those that are essentially valid, not to those which are simply the products of imagination or of the particular stress of the psyche as the result of disturbances of the outer life. Assuming, however, that the true vision occurs when man is receptive and is quiet, has entered the stillness, and is seeking to know the truth, or in those hours when this stillness is imposed upon him by nature, and therefore most suitable for the further imposition of a spiritual factor, where the vision is genuine, it nearly always has this sense of authenticity in it. It is meaningful, it is reasonable, it is proper. It is solutional. It carries with it a mark of validity, as though it was sealed by the very seal of God. Under such conditions, the individual is not even inclined to resist it. He is not inclined to doubt it. Its peculiar clarity and integrity come through to him. This may also be true of certain imaginary experiences, but less often. And one of the great keys that have been used down through the ages in determining the validity of vision is the consequence. That type of vision which changes the life of the person for the better, which takes the individual, as it took St. Francis of Assisi, out of a life of dissipation and intemperance and sanctified him to the best that he knew in the way of the service of the need of his fellow men, that kind of vision which brings great understanding, philosophic insight, or advances man's knowledge of things factual, that type of inner experience of auditory type which has been given to the great musician and composer, by which he has been able to bring through into objectivity melodies and marvelous harmonies which he has first heard as mystical happenings within his own consciousness. All of these things relate to the availability within man of a superior power capable of being released at need or under certain circumstances for the preservation or the improvement of his life or the service of his world. Where visions have led to great improvement, there is very little to be gained by doubting them. If, however, they do not lead to improvement, if they merely lead to fanaticism or mania, then we have no real need, under the study of psychology, to use this circumstance or such instances as a disproof of vision. It merely proves to us that these experiences can arise either from the lower psychic nature or the higher. And where they arise from the lower nature, regardless of the picturesqueness which they present, they tell the story of our sickness or our trouble. But where they arise from the deeper nature of man, they tell the story of his hope, of his aspiration, of his inner resource, of the spiritual destiny which is his in life, and the call to the recognition of higher levels of being, of purpose, of achievement, of realization than he has formerly known. Under these conditions, the vision becomes a vital experience, whether it occurs during sleeping or waking hours. But from its machinery, we can understand how nature very often involves it in the sleep mystery. Well, I think our time is up for this time, so I'll have to leave it till next week.